Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. I got one of our favorite questions showed up the other day. You know where I'm going with this, is because I mentioned it before I hit record. You're all gone already.
Yeah, well, we do have the ability to quickly, get into it here. So right. Go ahead.
All right. So for
what is the question, Fred?
Yeah. So this one came. I don't remember if it was direct or through LinkedIn, but the question was: is how many samples do I need to test to show X amount of reliability? And it was the way they phrased it. And I said, well, that's kind of the wrong question to be asking until some other things get answered. So I can probably answer it easily by saying you need more samples than you're going to get. And it's kind of a start.
And yeah, it's always more is better when it comes to samples and making any decision about some attribute to the sample. So,
Let's take it from, break it down a couple different ways. So first off, somebody comes to you and says, we've got this box. And just before we started, I was having trouble with my little mixer box that I use for my microphone. And, so somebody hands you one of these things, or you're working with a team that says, we need to make sure that this is going to last for 5 years. And it's in a studio environment. So it'll get regular use, 5 days a week, easy.
All right.
Right. How would you go about saying that there's going to be a relatively low probability of failing in 5 years so that we can support our warranty program or whatever, right? They want to know a number. How reliable is it? How many are likely to fail in 5 years? How would you go about answering that question?
Well, obviously that's, you say you're not just born yesterday. I mean, in this case, you would, have a lot of questions, like you just said, to the individual.
So what questions?
What is this a first, a new generation product, or you've never built something like this before? Do you have and if this is a follow-on product, do you have a predecessor product that had similar assembly parts, components? I assume you have plugs in this. There's mechanical interfaces to the microphones themselves, and that's the kind of, you do sort of an FMEA, quick, maybe casual look over the products. Getting all the information you could about the predecessor product or any reported history of the predecessor product's failure or design issues or anything like that. And then once you had all that information, examining the product, looking for, especially the mechanics that, eventually probably will, the contact surfaces, plating on the plug contact surfaces, those would things be eventually worn out because of the mechanical actions of the insertion and removal of the interfaces. So as far as, does it have does it have active components in it? Have those shown any history of failure? Are they new ASICs, or are they standard generic IC amplifier, things like that? So you'd first get an assessment of where they were in the technology and whether it's, then I always look, and as far as trying to make an estimate of the past or the future failure rates, you've got to go back to the field. I mean, that's, to me, is, if you've never made this product before, then maybe there's some other way to assess how your competitor or whoever was making this kind of product. But I think the most reliable or the most informative is looking back at the field failure rates of the predecessor product and trying to understand why those causes, what caused those failures. And if you say, okay, 3% was caused by this poor solder process or this you know, loose nut that nobody was torquing down in the case sufficiently, and it came loose and shorted out something. You eliminate those things, and so you say, well, you know, we've eliminated most everything we can think of, most everything that had been shown as a weakness in the predecessor product, you know, and make an assessment of that. Then I would focus on, if you only had 3 samples, certainly knowing the weakest link or what the field most likely failure in the field would be, I would start addressing that and applying specific stresses, whether it be using repetitive insertion and removal of electric contacts. That's certainly something I did in the big computer company, is direct people to unplug a USB port and plug in over 5,000 times, I believe, one model. So those kind of things would be the most likely. I'm guessing this box, unless it has an equalizer in it, doesn't have many electronic components. Is that correct?
I don't know. I haven't taken it apart yet.
Does it have knobs and adjustments and volume and a power?
Does it have
a power
input? Oh, I'm sure it's powered through USB, so it's relatively low power, but it's probably got something to, it's probably got a couple of circuit boards, and it's got knobs and dials and plugs and on the front and the back. Yeah. So there's probably 3 circuit boards in there all together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and probably so pretty standard technology. It's not high zoots by any means. I can't imagine.
Right. So, you know, my the thing I do is just check its performance. Then I would tend to monitor, I'd plan on a stress test. That's my next thing, is to find out in a very measured way what the weak links or what the weaknesses of the product are under different kinds of stresses. And just to be able to stress to its maximum capability, I'd try to find the boundaries, the limits of the stress, first being cold, because that usually doesn't do anything, and, you know, operate, first come up with a plan on what I'm going to test, what functions I'm going to test in that box, and what I would look for the most comprehensive testing that I could think of, or active, like if you have multiple channels in that box and multiple channels out, I would load those up and make sure all of them could operate simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Then I might, you know, look at the output level from the outputs while I'm stressing it, and seeing, if it may be that you can't get this thing to find a limit with the stresses with minus 40 or what the limits of most thermal chambers. Mm-hmm. So I would be monitoring the outputs of those signals with a constant input signal, and watch the maybe the performance curve drop off or change, may get better.
Yeah.
You never know.
Well, you're describing doing a halt test.
Anyway, it will change.
It will change eventually, but you're describing going to halt. But you know that if you finish the halt, you still don't know if 2% are going to fail in 5 years.
No, you don't, because actually if you're 2% of the failures, or the ones that were failing, the 2%, were because of a reflow, a solder reflow problem during the manufacturing process. No.
Well, no. Part of this is, the question came from, we're getting this thing from a vendor, right? And you can imagine the vendor is going to say, oh, trust us, it's good. Or they're going to say, oh, we did a parts count prediction, it's good. Here's your MTBF number. What else do you need? And they say, trust us, we know how to build it. We've built 2 of them already. And I agree with you, is that the first step is really understand what's the risk, what's at risk, what's the technology,
right. what's the history,
do we have anything, you know, right. experience or anything else, but
right.
And, but it still doesn't answer the question, is if at the end of the program you want to make a decision. I mean, you've heard my story of getting into reliability. My boss walked yeah. in with a product and said, will this last for 20 years? You know, and my first inkling, well, let's go put it in where it's supposed to be used and monitor it for 20 years. We'll find out. Yeah, you know, exactly. put it if
in
you're
20 years, yeah,
you know, use yeah. it
will
like
last
it's supposed
for 20
to.
Years? I don't know, it'll be technologically obsolete in 5.
Oh, no, these cables. No, it's a product that it doesn't really change all that much. We put a bunch of heavier jackets on it so it could go on concrete. And and the point was, is that the change in process that we used to make the product, right, the active element was identical to other products.
Okay.
But they weren't expected to last for 20 years. They were on like oil refinery piping and systems that okay. would get completely stripped and refurbished every 5 years. So we didn't have long-term history. And so the question was, we need to prove, you know, kind of like creating your own physics of failure model. You got to understand the failure mechanism. You got to understand right. how it behaves. You got to understand how it reacts right. to different stresses and so on.
Right.
And so I know you and I come at this from very different realms. That's why I wanted to bring it up to you.
Okay.
You know, and I agree with you, is if I have good history, if I have good background, if I know what's most likely to fail, and if I've got wear mechanisms, I can experiment with those. Those are all
right.
reasonable tests.
Okay.
But it doesn't, you have to be careful. If I'm only looking at one or two failure mechanisms, what about that other part? Right. And at the other
what
caveat,
other
like a capacitor, we got the soldering down, but right. now we damage capacitors okay. when we're putting them in. Right. And so, or the vendor sends us a bad batch. Right.
There's, well, that's right. right. That's always a risk in the supply chain.
Right.
In fact, that's a big contributor to field failures. So.
Right. So it's if you have history, if you've got yeah. the technology background and all the other stuff, yeah. you can factor those things in. The hard part is, to me, and the way I answered this question was okay. very much like what you said, is understand the technology, understand the risks, do an FMEA, you know, get a sense of what are the critical few things that are most likely to lead to failures. But keep mm-hmm. in mind, there's lots of other things that are could have lurking hidden defects. So HALT is a great way to expose some of that stuff. Like you said, the bolt that's not torqued properly, or the cold solder joints, or
right.
all kinds of cool yeah. stuff like that. The right. other piece is if I want to run an accelerated test, I need to know what environment is used in, what stresses is it expected to see, but more importantly is what are the failure mechanisms that are likely to cause it to fail, right? Like you said, if I have a connector and I know I'm getting plating wear, you know, my first take on that would be, well, let's cross-section the thing and see how good the plating is, right? If it's really porous yeah. gold,
right.
and, you know, we're out of business already. If it's, you right. know, if it's really thick and bonded real well, all those things, then mm-hmm. it's less of a risk. I'd say do the research.
Right.
But
right.
when you set up an accelerated life test, it's not like you stick the whole product in a thermal chamber for 6 weeks and call it good, because that temperature only accelerates things that accelerate temperature or accelerate
chemical
failure
reactions. Right.
Right.
For the most part.
For the most part.
So batteries, other things. Right. And then there's some like contamination, like chemical contamination on
right.
the edge of DIMM modules. I always saw that as
oh, yeah.
being activated by temperature and humidity.
But let's say you have something that has a lot of two mismatched materials that have a lot of difference in the coefficient of thermal
expansion. Yes, that's in fact, historically, especially underfill in some BGAs has been mismatched.
Right.
The TCEs are mismatched, so it causes the solder bumps to
crack. So I need 800 samples for the high temperature, and I need 674 samples for the thermal cycling, and I need 4,028 for the connectors and for the process control. And so my first answer,
if it costs a dime a piece, it's okay, you know.
Yeah, Well, I told you the one where these guys wanted me to
do it. 10 cents. You can get 1,000, you know, but, yeah. You know, that's another
question. That's a different question. Problem. Yeah.
How much does that box cost, and how much is failure cost in the field? Right. And, you know, those are the kind of things you'd have to weigh. I mean, there'd be some things I'd hardly want to, you know, if it's a $10, I mean, you can get a dollar calculator now, a dollar electronic, you know, scientific. I think if you go to the dollar store, you can get a scientific calculator for a dollar.
Yeah.
But I'm not, you know, that's not reasonable to spend it very much money at all in testing that or even evaluating it, because the cost, it's just prohibitive. You couldn't.
Well, you know. No, I disagree. There are circumstances, and it was one of my favorite test designs was for zip ties, the little plastic ties that have a threaded end and you can
cinch
them tight, right?
Yeah.
So this was for a solar field, and they use zip ties to secure the cables from one panel to the next as their distribution line. And they
And they want how long it lasts.
They didn't care how long it lasts. They had three options, three different vendors, all claiming that they were going to last forever.
Okay.
And they already knew from experience that just any old random zip tie doesn't last forever. They break down, right. and then once the cable gets loose, then the connectors break.
Yeah.
And then you got to run a truck out there, which is where the expenses, the cost of repair, right. the loss of power, costs way more than a zip tie.
Right? Okay.
But they didn't want to go back and redo them all with metal fastenings, because that has its own set of problems of cutting through cables.
Right.
And the installation cost is also a big factor. So even though the zip ties were a fraction of a penny each, and they gave me thousands and thousands to test with, the problem was I only had so many ways to measure them, right? I had one Instron machine to do a tensile strength test on them.
Okay.
And that took a technician. And he looked at me with 1,000 samples and said, I really like doing these tests, but not that much.
Yeah. You know? So you got the distribution of the strength of the tie of the different samples?
Oh, we did a degradation test because we were exposing them to salt, fog, and UV. And
of course.
And as they broke down, we could see the chemical change through the tensile strength changes.
Right.
And then we're able to plot that out to show how long before it would fail under these accelerated conditions. But we did it at multiple stress levels, and we made a model. But it was, even with unlimited samples, we had other constraints. We had to get it done in a reasonable time.
Right.
We had only so much testing capability. I don't know.
But in that case, Fred, you had a simple device. With a simple
had one function. Failure mechanism, right?
One failure mechanism, right?
Yeah, the chemical.
But you had several stressors.
Yeah, because we knew that both of those.
Did you vary those?
Yes.
Did you see if you had a lot of UV light and less?
Well, I didn't have a good model to do the acceleration factor, so I had to create it. So we used multiple stress levels.
Oh, you didn't get the exposure times that it would be. These were solar panels, right? Photovoltaic.
Oh, I know, but these are the cable attachments underneath it, and so
But you know what the exposures to? Oh, did you? You didn't know what were they in shadows or?
Well, somewhere. We knew how much exposure they were getting.
Okay. But overall, the strength, the strongest ones, the ones that were more durable, would be the ones to use. Whatever condition.
It wasn't the strongest ones. That was the interesting.
Or the one that had the slowest degradation.
The one that had the right mix of additives to deal with the oxidation of the polymer chains.
Okay.
And so that formula wasn't the strongest, but it decayed the slowest.
Okay, right. The degradation of its strength.
Right. Okay. But we didn't know what those rates were. They each gave us these formulas and we're like, okay, what do we do with that? How do those work? And so we tried it. We experimented with it. Now, the issue is that the answer to the question that how many samples is, you got to, like you started with, Kirk, is well, what do you know and don't know? You might not even have to do a test. So zero samples is a viable option. If you know quite a bit about it, but you've only changed maybe the plating on the connector, maybe the simple test with a, you know, dozen or so samples to see what the rate of wear is. Mm-hmm. In other cases, you might have a dozen really complex new technology in it, and you're going to have to break it down and do a whole pile of testing or studies or evaluations or, you know, whatever.
Right.
It is so dependent. And the
adaptive to the product. Yes.
The first question is not how many samples do I need? The first question is how is it going to fail? What do I know and don't know?
Right.
And
exactly.
Like if you don't know how it's going to fail, well, go break it. Go do a halt and find out how it fails. And if you can fix those, fix them. If you can't fix them, you might have to run an accelerated test to say, well, how long does this happen in use conditions? And
right.
So the short answer to this one, Kirk, is easy. You need more samples than you ever dreamed you need, or you might need none.
More is better. And yes, it's a very complex issue, depending on the complexity of the product and thing you're trying to test. So and use environment, you know, there's so many questions, but I know that in all cases, it's difficult, especially in any development program, to get samples. Everybody wants them. They're scarce. They're extremely valuable. And if you say, I'm going to maybe break it, they will immediately put you at the bottom of the list.
Not
if they've had this experience before, knowing that it showed something that they experienced in the field.
That's
right.
Not if they get it. That's what I call it. So let us know. Does your team get it and you get enough samples, but you do the research, or are you pulling numbers out of a standard someplace? Geez, don't tell me you do that. But what are the constraints or factors that make a difference for you, and how do you go about it? We'd love to hear from you over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And we're turning around one of these questions that we've gotten from one of you, the listeners. And it really makes our day when, one, we get some feedback, and two, is we get a question that we can talk about. And we'll get you an answer as soon as we can, but we'll also probably put it in the queue for speaking of reliability. But sample size is a question, and you know it, Kirk, is we get it all the time, and there's no one answer for it.
Well, there's no one answer, and I always question trying to quantify life and rates of, you know, just without, again, I think your field data of predecessor products is, if it's same manufacturing conditions, same, factories, same use conditions, you're probably going to get the similar failure rates in a new product, number of manufacturers. So that's the way to go for me. And I think that more detailed analysis later when you, when you get an actual part or whatever and can go into detail and test. And you said test to limits.
Go break it. That's always the fun part. All right, well, thanks, Kirk. I figured you'd have a good take on this one.
Thanks, Red. Good. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.